Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
That's kind of conversation to your soul. That's conversation to your soul and the night.
Prestige heads, and welcome to American Prestige. I'm Danny Bessner, here as always with my friend and comrade Derek Davison, and we're very excited to welcome back to the podcast today returning champion Udi Greenberg, who is not only my old friend, but who also functions as our Israel desk. And we've invited Udi, who is an associate professor at Dartmouth College, to talk about politics in Israel and just what has been going on there. So Udi, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So I guess the first basic question is, we had you on about a year-ish ago to talk about the domestic situation in Israel and how things have been shaping up since the October 7th attack and Israel's subsequent annihilation of Gaza. So what's happened in the last year? I guess to begin as a broad question, and however you want to go, and then we'll go into further details. But how have political developments occurred? What is the domestic situation? Are people still talking about the hostages? All that stuff.
Right. So I would say that the most remarkable phenomenon in Israeli domestic politics over the last year is its remarkable stability. At the immediate aftermath of the attacks in October, there was a massive public opinion shift against Netanyahu and his coalition. Public polling, his coalition was polling very, very poorly. Within a few months, however, a shift returned back. And since then, public polling has more or less stabilized in the same place it was 2 years ago with the beginning of the judicial overhaul process. The ruling coalition is currently polling at roughly 40 to 45% of the vote, and the opposition parties are polling at roughly 55% of the vote. That has been static. It has changed very little over the last year, despite fairly important developments, both domestically and internationally. The first being the withdrawal of the centrist party from the unity coalition that was formed at the immediate aftermath of the attack to conduct the war. The centrist party has declared that it will no longer participate in the coalition because it claimed that Netanyahu was prolonging the war unnecessarily and refusing for a deal to return the hostages home. That has changed nothing, as far as we can tell, in public opinions. The same, which surprised me personally more, is that a radical escalation of military activities in Lebanon in the previous fall in the war against Hezbollah also did not change the public perception of the ruling coalition. Even though it is considered widely among Israeli Jews to be a successful military operation, many people who criticized the government supported it. And nevertheless, this has not made Netanyahu and his coalition any more popular. Despite this stability and the lingering unpopularity of the ruling coalition, domestically in parliament, it has strengthened over the last few months. A small fraction from the centrist party has defected and joined the coalition, four members of parliament. So the size of the coalition grew from 64 members of parliament out of 120 in parliament to 68. So it now relies on an even larger parliamentary majority than it did before. And it likely will continue to serve until the end of term, at least 2 years from now.
So the obvious question is, what are the major factors driving Israeli politics? You hear in the United States almost casually that Israel is unique and that its youth are turning to the right and that it's a right-wing country. But what are the domestic drivers here for Netanyahu's survival after a gigantic intelligence failure? I mean, there's a lot of discussion about like Netanyahu's role in this in sort of a medium term, but I'd like to say it was an intelligence failure and not welcomed by the Netanyahu administration. what explains the fact that this guy is still in power after such a failure, and that he seems to have not a vice grip, but a pretty strong hold on Israeli domestic politics?
I think that there are several explanations for that, and this is a great question. The first fact is that the underlying sociological, political, and cultural forces that shape Israeli politics have not changed during this war, and despite of this war. This ruling coalition is unified by a set of overlapping concerns. The first for the ultra-Orthodox is the determination to avoid military conscription for ultra-Orthodox men. That is the single most important issue that is driving ultra-Orthodox politics. Netanyahu and the Likud party have committed themselves over and over to passing a law that will allow ultra-Orthodox to not serve in the military in perpetuity, against constant rulings by the Israel Supreme Court that claim that the current arrangement, which exempts ultra-Orthodox from service, is unconstitutional. The reason that this arrangement is important for the ultra-Orthodox is not only because of the question of military service itself, but also because of the gigantic system of welfare that is attached to it. Currently, ultra-Orthodox that do not serve in the military but enroll in ultra-Orthodox schools, yeshivas, receive very generous welfare payments that are not extended to the rest of the population, whether dental care, child support, and so on.
And this goes back to Ben-Gurion, right? Like, this is like foundational.
It goes to Ben-Gurion, that was the arrangement that exempted ultra-Orthodox students from military service goes all the way back to the founding of Israel. However, back at that time, we're talking about a few hundred people. The arrangement has been radically expanded in the 1970s and 80s by the Likud coalition, which saw cooperation with the Orthodox Party as a long-term strategy. Netanyahu has doubled down on this policy and has created a strong and even deepening bond between the Orthodox Party and the Likud as a result. The ultra-Orthodox parties themselves are not particularly interested in international affairs, in the relationship to the Palestinians. What they care in particular is about the preservation of the welfare arrangements that are attached to the exemption for military service. That explains why the ultra-Orthodox parties are so deeply attached to the bloc, the coalition bloc with Netanyahu. The Likud party itself probably is so committed to Netanyahu for the simple reason that in many ways, like the Republican attachment to Trump, he was a candidate that defied the odds back in the 1990s and won a very improbable victory. He again managed to defy the odds in his second career over the last 15 years or so and won several very close elections. Most of the members of the Likud also would prefer not to go for election anytime soon out of fear that the election anytime soon will likely mean loss of power for the Likud party. And therefore, the main constituting parties of the coalition are not interested in breaking it. The final component of the current coalition is the settler parties, of the far-right parties led by Bezalel Smotrich and Ben-Gvir. They, too, are mostly haunted by the memories of the 1990s. Back in 1991-92, the settler party broke with the Likud coalition in protest over the beginning of informal peace negotiations in Madrid back in 1991. The result of that decision back then was the fall of the right-wing government and the election of Labor and Yitzhak Rabin and the beginning of the Oslo process. The main lesson that the settlers have taken since then is that under no consequence can you or should you break an alliance with the Likud party, even if there are some disagreements about specific details here and there, because the consequence will likely mean the end of settlers' representation in power. So for that reason, all the parties are determined to keep Netanyahu and the people around him in power.
I just have a very quick question. It seems like the Likud has been very smart strategically with basically building a base that can't go anywhere else. Is that correct, whether we're talking about settlers or whether we're talking about the ultra-Orthodox, is that there's really no other place for them in Israeli politics. And in some sense, Likud has been drawn further to the right than it already was. But it seems like a pretty stable coalition, given that there's no other place for these people to go.
I would say it's a rock solid coalition. And for some, there was a brief hope that somehow the anger and frustration over the and shock over the attack, the Hamas attack in October, more than a year ago, that that would somehow would destabilize the coalition. The coalition would decide to fall apart. That proved to be a very brief moment that was quickly passed very quickly. I think that in general, one should understand this is not the reason that this coalition is so rock solid is not only because of the short-term calculation of the last few months or the last year. This coalition has been in the making for over 15 years. Netanyahu, over the 15 years, over and over, made sure to solidify the ties between the Likud, the ultra-Orthodox, and the settler parties, and out of long-term calculations that that will be the longest serving coalition in Israeli history, and it's proved to be quite successful in that. It's part of a long-term strategy that has to do a lot with demographics. As many of your listeners will know, the ultra-Orthodox population is by far the population that grows the fastest in Israel. Is the rate of the birth rates among ultra-Orthodox is exceptionally high, higher than the rest of the population. Currently, out of that is an information that was released, statistic that was released last year, roughly 40% of all students who are currently in first grades are in ultra-Orthodox schools and come from ultra-Orthodox families. Netanyahu, I think, quite consciously has made a long-term decision to commit to a coalition with the ultra-Orthodox population. Out of the calculation, this is a long-term strategy that will probably outlast him, that will guarantee right-wing rule in Israel for the foreseeable future.
So, Uri, I want to go back to, you talked about the influx of the four quote-unquote centrists, the Gideon Saar faction that came back in and is now, I think the last I saw, he was actually going to rejoin Likud, which he left to form his own party. And this, of course, involved the sacking of Yoav Gallant as defense minister and a bit of a cabinet shuffle to get Saar the position of foreign minister. I guess my first question, you see this portrayed in some media analysis as widening the sort of moderate conservative base of Netanyahu's coalition, meaning he's less vulnerable or has to, you know, it has to be less worried about what the Smotrich or Ben-Gvir factions may want. That math doesn't seem to work, right? The coalition is still very vulnerable to what those parties want, I think. But can you talk about whether there are any political implications here? And without getting into Netanyahu's psychology and what he really wants, does this stabilize him in any way to be less beholden to the far right?
He's less beholden to the far right only when it comes to maybe short-term calculations, when it comes for negotiations over passing of the budget. For example, recently there's been some kerfuffles between the Likud party and the settler parties, Ben-Gvir and Netanyahu particularly, about some minor priorities about the budget. The fact that this faction defected from the centrist party to and joined the coalition enabled the coalition to pass the budget without needing to negotiate or to get the votes of the small faction of settlers. But no, it does not change fundamentally anything important about the policy of the government and the ruling coalition. Ultimately, the difference between the small faction that rejoined the Likud now or is about to rejoin the Likud and the Likud party itself and the settler party is ideologically fairly marginal. To treat Saar himself as a moderate is a bit of a stretch. He himself has been one of the most hawkish politicians in Israeli politics. He called for the perpetual occupation of Gaza. He was an avid supporter of the escalation in Lebanon and a very vocal supporter of the attacks in Iran, which are a massive escalation in the Middle East. So he's, when it comes to international affairs, is considered one of the hard right, belligerent members of this coalition. So this is part of a just, so I wouldn't read this as any meaningful shift in Netanyahu's policies or the coalition's policies. It has been part of the long-term strategy of Netanyahu that he employed over and over again, is that in moments of instability, he always lures some politicians with promises of positions and thus shores up his coalition. He's done it many times in the past. The reason for Saar and his faction to rejoin the coalition is mostly a personal one. By all public polling, it's pretty clear that Saar was going to disappear from politics. He has no base and no body of voters that can guarantee his return to parliament should there be an election in the next 2 years. So he decided to just return to his political home in the Likud. And, you know, like many members of the Likud, he hopes that at some point Netanyahu will live political life. Maybe an opening.
I mean, what are they expecting? He seems like someone who's going to hold on to power just for his own, like for the personal corruption stuff. He has to, kind of.
I mean, and also ideologically, I think he's committed for the ideological project he has successfully pursued over the last two decades, over almost three decades now. And but he is aging and he's ailing. He just went through several medical procedure this week. That's one of the reasons that his corruption trial is suspended, is because he's recovering from. So I think many of them are just hoping that at some point, whether naturally or politically, he will be forced out of political life. And they hope to be the next in line. Those are fantasies that are not likely to materialize, but that is the calculation.
Udi, a very ignorant question, just very quickly, Derek. Netanyahu can't pardon himself like Trump can? That's not available in Israeli politics? Okay.
No, pardoning in Israel is granted by the president, who's mostly informal. Symbolic figure. He has no political power, but the only power that the president formally has that is meaningful is the right to pardon. There has been some discussions about whether the president would agree to pardon Netanyahu in advance in exchange for his willingness to retire from political life. I don't know where those ideas come from, where those fantasies come from. That is something that's been floated here and there by journalists. It is not in the making. It's not in the books. And it's not likely that the current president will intervene in such way in politics. He has largely tried to present himself as nonpartisan and to stay away out of partisan politics.
I wanted to ask about the decision to sack Gallant. How much of that had to do with the public disagreements, and Gallant had made them public over the hostage negotiations and Netanyahu, kind of sabotaging them at every time it seemed like they were getting close to a deal. And you had Gallant kind of, you know, going public really, or, you know, being leaked that he and Netanyahu were getting into shouting matches in cabinet, versus their disagreements over the ultra orthodox conscription, which seemed like a deeper issue. Because at the end of the day, they might disagree on the whether they should do a temporary hostage deal. But I didn't feel like there was a big daylight between Gallant and Netanyahu on prosecuting what they're doing in Gaza, as opposed to the ultra orthodox thing, where Gallant seemed to be really kind of steadfast, demanding that their exemptions be lifted. And Netanyahu, of course, for political reasons, didn't want to do that.
Right. This is a great question. It goes to the core of what constitutes this coalition. I think that is important to talk about. The disagreement between Gallant and Netanyahu over the hostages has been kind of brewing over a very long time, but Gallant himself never said anything particularly belligerent on this case, never indicated he's going to be vocal on this issue or that he's going to resign in protest. That has been kind of a, you know, back burner issue that occasionally he would make a comment about it. Especially in private meetings, never in public. The main reason for the hostility between Gallant and Netanyahu had to do with the judicial overhaul program. All the way back, long before the Hamas attack in the beginning of the war in Gaza and in Lebanon, Gallant himself was somewhat hesitant about some aspect of the judicial overhaul. He was especially worried about the fact that so many high-tech pilots and other volunteers on whom the Israeli Air Force relied declared that they will not continue to volunteer if the judicial overhaul will continue. That is why he was sacked originally a year and a half ago, and the protest over the sacking led Netanyahu to reinstate him. However, about half a year ago, the Minister of the of Legal Affairs, Yariv Levin, declared that the judicial overhaul project is back and that he and the coalition intend to pursue all aspects of it that have been suspended once the war began. Most importantly, the capacity to change the functioning of the Supreme Court and several other important functions of the of state workers and state employment and judicial review of the executive. Gallant himself has been, again, very hesitant about it, and he made some comments that were interpreted as him opposing the return of the judicial overhaul. And it is likely for that reason that he was fired from the position of Minister of Defense. So it had even less to do, definitely nothing to do with the hostages, but even less to do with the effort to exempt ultra-Orthodox for military service, which probably would pass without Gallant support. The main issue is whether the ruling coalition should pursue the judicial overhaul, and Netanyahu want to make sure that the one opponent in the coalition of the judicial overhaul does not have the position of the Minister of Defense when he opposes it. That, again, proved to be a wise calculation. Gallant decided not only to accept his firing fairly quietly, but he also then proceeded last week to resign from his position as member of parliament for the Likud, thus making sure that his replacement will enter parliament, and that is a man that will 100% will vote with the ruling coalition on the judicial overhaul.
So does he just go away now? Does he emerge as like a figure in the, again, what passes for center in Israeli politics? Like, I've gotten a big kick out of, like, even after he got sacked, you had like the Biden administration bringing Gallant to Washington and like hosting him and meeting with the Secretary of Defense and meeting with Antony Blinken as though he still had some role in any of this. It was just very funny to watch that. And it made me curious what his political future might be. He doesn't seem to be a terribly gifted politician, but you know, who knows?
He's not a particularly gifted politician. He's also not all that popular. He doesn't have a particular base or an army of supporters. It's hard to know what he anticipates happening. It could be that what he's planning on is joining some other centrist party for the next election. It might be that he plans on running in the internal primaries in the Likud and to securing high enough position that he can return to the Likud as a member of parliament. I think that is not likely scenario, but it could be that that's what he's fantasizing about. And it could be that he's just going to vanish and slowly fade away. He's not a particularly charismatic figure, and it's unclear what he will be bringing if he wanted to join a different party. It could be that he might be joining Benny Gantz and the other generals in the general so-called centrist party for the next election. But yeah, he will, the highest likelihood is that, like, everyone from the Likud party who disagreed with Netanyahu is just pushed out and slowly fade from public life.
Speaking of fading from public life, obviously we're going to talk about Gaza, but where is the center and left in Israeli politics at this moment? Maybe you could also remind people about this whole judicial reform protest, which was happened in advance of the October 7th attacks, which it did seem like there was some political something happening, and that was totally cut off. So for people who might not remember, because it seems like a century ago.
Right. So the government roughly 2 years ago declared that it was going to completely transform the judicial system, following the guidelines of what has been implemented in Poland, in Hungary, and elsewhere, by essentially eliminating the independence of the judiciary and making all parts of the state answer only to the executive. That included changing the Supreme Court composition, changing the authority of what the Supreme Court is allowed to rule on, but also transforming the civil service. So considerable part of the civil service in Israel is non-partisan and is not appointed by politicians. Most importantly, legal advisor to government ministries are all appointed by an independent committee, and they are the ones who can okay or stop ministerial actions and appointments, whether they are considered legal or not. The government, the coalition wanted to abolish these positions and make them answer only to the appointing minister, thus eliminating any judicial independence. The massive protest did not manage to stop the judicial overhaul, but the threat of refusing to serve in to volunteer in the military by many of the high visibility figures like pilots and so on managed to delay it a little bit, and then the war seemed to put the judicial overhaul on ice. And as I said, about half a year ago, the ruling coalition decided it is going to again pursue the judicial overhaul, either by passing new laws — this has not happened yet, that is in the making, that's being in discussion — or by simply disobeying ruling of the Supreme Court. For example, the Supreme Court ordered the Minister of Legal Affairs to convene the committee that elects new Supreme Court justices, since several have retired half a year ago and they have not been replaced, and he simply has refused to do so. The same has happened. Netanyahu appointed a person who was considered disqualified by the legal advisor to the cabinet, and Netanyahu appointed him anyway. So what seems to be is kind of a slowly creeping judicial overhaul taking place. Thus far, however, no protest has materialized in response to that. There are some demonstrations here and there, but certainly nothing close to the mass protest and mass mobilization that took place a year and a half ago. Israeli society has been exhausted and distracted by the war. Many of the people who fight the war themselves have been central activists in the protest against the judicial overhaul and are simply absent. There has been, it's hard to gauge the size, but there has been a considerable rise in negative migration. Many people who were very much involved in the protest have decided to pack their things and move to Europe or to the United States or elsewhere, which has drained the protest movement from some of its key activists. So thus far, there has been no major protests and no major resistance to the ruling coalition.
And so does that speak more broadly about the center and left in Israeli society?
Yes, it does. I mean, the Israeli left has disappeared long ago. It is a tiny, tiny minority. What is considered the center has not been ideologically all that different than the right, especially not when it comes to the relationship to the Palestinians. No one in the Israeli center has opposed the war. The only issue that they have been, or the mass murder of civilians in Gaza, the only point of disagreement has been about the question of should there be a negotiation with Hamas on, to bring back the hostages or not. That has been the only point of disagreement. Many people from the so-called center have said that they support negotiations, a ceasefire agreement to bring back the hostages, in order to then relaunch the war against Gaza. That has been one point that has been made by several so-called centrist politicians. So when it comes to the question of the occupation, the relationship to Palestinians, Israel's position in the Middle East, and so on, there hasn't been any major difference between the so-called opposition and the coalition.
So let's talk about the politics around national security. And you mentioned earlier that things have sort of returned to where they were prior to October 7th, 2023, and when they were just on the verge of discussing the judicial reform. Where do people stand on Netanyahu, or where does sort of the general public mood about Netanyahu as a national security figure, having, you know, that reputation having taken a huge hit after the October 7th attacks, but now, you know, Ismail Haniyeh is dead, Hassan Nasrallah is dead, there's a, you know, claim, you can claim success in Lebanon, you can claim something in Syria. I don't know what the politics of Syria are. Maybe you could talk about that a little bit and how they've that's resonated in among the Israeli public. But just kind of in general, where do people stand now in terms of Netanyahu and their comfort level with him still in charge of their security?
I would say that they have been more or less where they stood at the before the beginning of the war. There is a small but very solid minority that considers him a very gifted politician, successful diplomat, and continue to believe in his conduct. There is a slim majority that considers him an incompetent prime minister that should not be serving as the leader of the country, but it is a very slim majority. What has been remarkable is that despite the drama of the last year and a half and the radical upheavals that took place in the Middle East, this has not changed in any meaningful way. There have been barrages of attacks from Iran on Israel, something that has never happened in the Middle Eastern history, and they happened more than once. There's been a radical escalation of the war in Lebanon that has been considered universally a success by Israeli Jews. Many in Israel considers the fall of the Assad regime to be a direct domino effect of the blow that Hezbollah has taken, and consider that also as an achievement for Netanyahu. The Israeli military not only has dislodged one of the enemy regimes, though indirectly, but it also occupied the Hermon Mountains on the border with Syria and expanded its control into Syrian territories. That has all been considered a success by many in Israel. And nevertheless, Netanyahu's own popularity, the question of is he fit to serve as prime minister, is he considered a successful diplomat, that the numbers on that have not changed over the last year and a half. The numbers have remained remarkably stable. Those who support him continue to support him. Those who oppose him continue to consider him an incompetent and dangerous leader. But it seems like very little in the course of events seems to move the numbers. And for that, in this regard, I take it that is an important. There's been so much talking about Netanyahu as a person and how important he is for Israeli politics. The fact that his numbers aren't moving to me seem to indicate that the causes for support or opposition for Netanyahu are much deeper than the person himself. They have much more to do with the deep structural sociopolitical division in Israeli societies, Israeli society. And it is likely that even if he were to retire here tomorrow, we won't see any dramatic change for Israeli politics.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Is there anything to be said for the fact that he's been the central figure in Israeli politics for, you know, 20 years now or whatever it's been? And there's just not that much movement that's going to happen. Like, people's opinions of him are baked in at this point. Does that factor into
it? It could be, but I mean, I should also remind people that parliamentary politics are not as dependent on the individual in the same way that they are in presidential election in the United States. People do not vote for a person. They voted for a party. In that regard, it is not him as the person. Even though he seems to be the center of politics, he's a very gifted politician. He's an expression of deep structural transformation of Israeli political structure and socioeconomic conditions that he, in my view, exemplifies more than he shapes.
Where do things stand in terms of, to focus on the Lebanon front for a second before we move into Gaza, maybe, where do things stand in terms of bringing people back to northern Israel who left in the midst of the exchanges with Hezbollah? Like, is that happening? Is there reluctance? Are people skeptical that the deal is going to hold? Like, what's the sentiment?
Some people have been returning. Many people are still skeptical. This has not been a full return. Many of the places are still ruined by as a consequence of the bombardment, especially some farms on the borders with Lebanon. So, the population number is relatively small. We're talking about a few dozen thousand people. So some of them have returned, but many have not yet. Life has definitely not been, has not resumed. Normal life has not resumed quite yet in northern Israel.
I think now we should move on to Gaza. So a lot of different ways we can take this move, but I think what a lot of our listeners will be wondering is, first, do the people in Israel see the images that we see here of dead children, flattened cities, like really, I think the worst images I've seen in a public fora, you know, not in an archive or something like that. And then two, what is the thought about this annihilation at this point? It's like, it's like a Vernichtung, right. Like literally, you know?
The majority of Israelis are not exposed to this. Most of them live on the diet of Israeli press, which does not show those images. You have to, if you're an Israeli, you need to actively seek those images to see them. They are aware of the numbers. They are aware of the scale of destruction, even though they don't necessarily see it visually. There doesn't seem to be any major humanitarian concern among most Israelis. There's a tiny minority that occasionally makes comments about it and protests the mass killing in Israel, but that is limited to a tiny, tiny fringe. The overwhelming majority of the Jewish population in Israel still supports this war and is completely indifferent to the mass murder. And even though many know that the overwhelming majority of people who died in Gaza are not involved in the fighting, that those are civilians, they are children, the numbers are well known to the Israeli public. The Israeli public seems profoundly indifferent, if not hostile, to the suffering.
I just have to ask, as Israelis in the diet, like, what do you think about that? That to me is just, you know, as a Jew, it's wild.
I mean, I consider it moral monstrosity. It's very hard to digest that, regardless of what one thinks about Hamas and regardless of what one thinks even about the legitimacy of a military operation against Hamas. I find it incredibly difficult, regardless of that, find it very difficult to justify killing and destruction of this scale. Much of it is intentional. That is something that is not a secret. I mean, Israeli soldiers constantly report that they are inflicting violence and destruction as vengeance and without any military purpose. That is well known, that is well reported, that is well documented. I find it difficult to digest and to justify. And like you, I mostly stand speechless at those atrocities.
What's the thinking, what are the discussions that are happening in Israeli media, Israeli politics, about, you know, an end point to this and a day after scenario, for lack of a better term?
There is none. Is a great question. Okay. The answer that there is none. Netanyahu has specifically said that there is no point on discussing the day after. The only plan thus far that has been fleshed out for the day after has been by settlers who varied from...
Well, that was going to be my next question. Yeah, is how much purchase that has, the idea of going back into Gaza and settling.
The settlers say quite explicitly, the organized parties and congresses and events to prepare for the resettlement of Gaza with Jewish settlers. There's been, as you know, a mass evacuation of the civilian population in northern Gaza to force hundreds of thousands of people away from northern Gaza into the southern part. Settlers say quite explicitly that they expect this area to be annexed into Israel and to be resettled with Jewish settlers. Some of them have said that the same should happen in southern Lebanon, that southern Lebanon should be occupied and annexed. That is likely, that is less likely to take place. That has been the only explicitly plans that have been fleshed out. The Israeli government has explicitly banned any talk of the day after. It refuses to engage in the discussion of what comes after and says that this discussion will take place only after the war is over. When this will happen and what shape it will take is left for us to speculate.
That's very interesting. It'll be over when the war, we'll talk about it when the war is over. Well, when's the war going to be over?
Yes, Netanyahu himself said explicitly that there will be no discussion of the day after anytime soon. Formally, that's one of the reasons that the centrist party left his coalition.
To continue on the idea of settlement and move maybe more broadly and look at the West Bank as well, we have to talk about where or what the expectations are, I guess, for the incoming Trump administration, which came very close. I recognized Israeli sovereignty over the Golan, came close, I think, were it not for the Abraham Accords, to probably giving Netanyahu the green light to do some partial annexation in the West Bank. What are the expectations this time around in terms of how much latitude Netanyahu, and in particular on the subject of settlements and annexation, how much latitude there's going to be?
Right. It's hard to tell. I mean, the incoming president's mercurial personality makes it somewhat difficult to anticipate what positions he will take, especially on topics like the Middle Eastern conflict, in which he has no personal investment, as far as we know. All indications are that policy of the incoming administration in the U.S. will be similar to the one of the outgoing administration and the one before it and the one before it, which is occasionally paying lip service to the notion that peace should be achieved. Maybe that will be discarded too, while you're supporting Israeli decision to unilaterally shape reality on the ground, whether through the expansion of the settlements in the West Bank, which has continued uninterrupted over the last several decades, whether under Democratic or Republican administrations, or for the de facto or the legal annexation of parts of it. I personally am not quite sure how dramatic an annexation of the West Bank or part of the West Bank will be. In practice, Israeli law is already enacted on Jewish settlers, and military law is enacted on Palestinian population in the West Bank. The Israeli government decides everything about life of Palestinians and Jews alike in the West Bank. It determines the allocation of resources, the right of movement. It controls the taxes, even the taxes that are allegedly run by the Palestinian Authority are collected and controlled by the Israeli Ministry of Treasury. The annexation in many ways will be a formal recognition of what is the reality on the ground, but it's unclear to me that it will actually change anything on the ground. So it could be that will be that the Netanyahu coalition is hoping that Trump's entry will lead to formal annexation, but whether it will or not, I'm not sure that it will be hugely consequential.
What about the idea of, you know, another thing that Trump wanted and then Biden pushed hard for, which is the expansion of the Abraham Accord framework to include Saudi Arabia?
That's what I was going to ask. Derek, can I just quickly jump in? Because to me, even if Netanyahu says he doesn't have a plan, the plan to me seems pretty obvious, is that they want to basically solve the Palestinian fraga. They want to occupy new areas, and they think in 5 years, MBS and the rest of the Arab world, or even Islamic world more broadly, except Iran, is not going to really care, and Israel is going to have normalized relations. To me, that seems to be the strategy. And I think that piggybacks right off of Derek's question. One, do you think that's an accurate understanding? And then two, how do they plan to get there?
It seems to be pretty accurate understanding of Netanyahu's strategy. His operating assumption, you will have to ask whether it is based on reality or not. Someone who's a specialist of the Arab world.
Sure,
but his operating assumption is that the overwhelming majority of Arab leaders do not care about the Palestinian question. The historical record shows that they're right, that he's right in this calculation. The Saudis have said that they will wait for normalization with Israel until there is an Palestinian state. Whether this will be true 5 years from now, like you said, is remain to be seen. His operating assumption is that Israel can pursue normalization with some regimes like the Saudis, like this maybe the new Syrian regime, that will come without compromising on the Palestinian question while continuing to hold Palestinian territories and deepening the occupation. That is operating assumption, and is that is what the policy is geared toward. It seems like the United States is actively seeking to realize this vision by trying to get the Saudis and Israelis together, all while not pursuing any self-determination for the Palestinian people. So in that regard, it seemed like the Americans and the Israelis are seeing eye to eye.
So Udi, I think we've done a nice little survey of Israeli politics. And here's the question, and I ask you to be as realistic, which might involve being pessimistic as possible, but is there any actual hope for change here? The United States seems dedicated to enabling Israel to do whatever it wants. Israel seems dedicated to a project of settler colonization and regional normalization. So is there any hope of change, or is this kind of like...
And Derek. Yeah, well, just to kind of piggyback on that a little bit, what we haven't talked about are... Because, you know, frankly, they're not as salient for Israeli politics. But we haven't talked about other players here or potential players. We haven't talked about China. We haven't talked about Europe. We've seen European states, you know, moving in the direction of recognizing Palestine. Does any of that, you know, can any of that, you know, be a factor here moving forward, I guess would be my...
Right. It's my, a great question.
Part of that question.
That's a great question. So in the short term, it doesn't seem to be any prospect of any change. Consensus about supporting Israel among the U.S. seems to be rock solid, despite some the eruption of protests last year. The European governments seem to be strongly committed to supporting Israel. Even those who declared support recognition of Palestine doesn't mean anything, right? None of them then proceeded to boycott Israel or to limit relationships with Israel over the occupation of the West Bank. That seems to be mostly at the declarative levels. So in the short term, it's hard to see any change coming. However, changes, when it comes, often comes very quickly and surprisingly. There's been a civil war in Syria for decades, over their decade, and the regime suddenly collapsed overnight. It's likely that if a change will come, it will come from transformation and refiguration of American politics. Either something will happen in American politics that will make support for Israel questionable for enough participants in the political process, or from a swift decline in American power and the shift of American strategy in the Middle East and the rise of other players that are currently not particularly involved. Who those will be, we don't know. But if a change is going to come, it's likely will be a result of these configurations.
Well, Udi, thank you so much for joining us. Even if you painted a bit of a grim picture, we live in a grim world, and so you only have to laugh to keep from crying. So thank you so much. We'll absolutely have you on again soon. And we actually hope to have you on again to discuss your forthcoming book unrelated to Israel, on Catholic Protestant rapprochement. I've read a lot of it. It is excellent. And we can move away from this for a little bit. So Udi, thank you so much for joining us. Everyone buy his book when it comes out, and we'll see you again soon. Bye.
Thank you for having me.
Bye.
Desk. 89% of business leaders say AI is a top priority. The right choice is crucial, which is why teams at one-third of Fortune 500 companies use Grammarly. Grammarly is the right AI assistant for your team. With top-tier security credentials and 15 years of experience in responsible AI, Grammarly is how companies like yours increase productivity while keeping data protected and private. See why 70,000 teams trust Grammarly at grammarly.com/enterprise.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.